The question that I get asked most often, and the thing that I get asked to address most often, is how to have a growing congregation, one that really grows and thrives, not just in number, but really grows in how they minister to others and how they minister to themselves and how they go about doing those things. I was at one congregation, and one of the elders came up and said, "You know, it's really hard to be a growing church. You know, we meet for a couple of hours on Sunday morning. We meet on Wednesday, and yet we can't seem to grow." And I said, "Well, if you limit yourself to those times, I'm pretty much assured you're not going to grow. It is an all-the-time thing. But more than that, church growth is dependent on every member of the body working together. In 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and also Romans chapter 12, it's nice how that works out, Paul talks to us about how the assembly or the congregation or the church is a body that's dependent equally on all of its parts. Well, if I had a body and only 2% of it worked, or 3%, or 5%, or 10%, or even 20% of it worked, I wouldn't be much of a person. I wouldn't get a lot of things done. My eyes are slowly, gradually stopping to work. Every year, my eyes get a little bit worse and all those things. And it's really a problem for me because I would like to have every body part working well. I think we all would. And one great key to success is every part has to be working together in order for the church really to grow. But I have found something in Scripture that comes across as maybe the most important key. And it sounds so simple, even though it's a little shocking to say, but there is a key for a congregation being able to grow in this world. And we ask ourselves, well, what is this key? Is it perfect leaders? Well, the answer is no. God has done some incredible, great things with imperfect leaders, like Moses. Imperfect leaders, like Abraham. Imperfect leaders, like Peter. You know, in fact, whenever you look at the leadership trends across the text, there is only one perfect leader, and his own disciples in the end had a hard time following him. Jesus was that perfect leader, but other than that, God has used amazingly imperfect people to do incredible things in his kingdom. Well, then, is the answer perfect members? Is that the key to church growth? Well, we don't have all perfect members. I have on my wall in my office in Lubbock a picture of a congregation that's in Atlanta, Georgia. And it's called the Perfect Church. The sign over the door says Perfect Church. And I'm convinced that it really is. There are boards over all the windows and over all the doors to keep people out. And if you keep everybody out, you do have the perfect church. Of course, you don't have the people you're there to minister to, and you don't have any ministry or any work, but you don't have those problems coming in. But since we are filled with people, we've got to realize that we have to use imperfect people to do great ministry in this world. Well, what is the key? Perfect programs? You know, maybe if we develop the ideal evangelism program and visitation program and all these things, if we come up with the best ideas, then we will have a fantastic, healthy, growing congregations. Well, what's really true is programs don't work everywhere. They actually don't work anywhere. Eventually, every program falls apart. But programs, you can't take what one congregation is doing and just go apply it at another one. Very seldom does it work that way. A lot of the congregations I work with have tried everything. They've tried everybody's program. The last congregation I was working with, they had had Rick Warren from the Saddleback Community Church come in and teach them how to organize themselves because they said, we figured if no one in the Brotherhood could help us, we would ask him. And they went from about 220 members down to 18 members. And I said, well, how'd that work for you? They said, well, that really stunk. And I said, you know, anytime you get away from the book and you buy a book, you end up having problems. But perfect programs aren't the answers either. The answer, very simply, is found in 1 John chapter number 3, verse 11 through verse 15. I'd like for us to read that together. 1 John chapter number 3, verse 11 through verse 15.
The Apostle John, the Apostle of Love, the one Jesus loved, writes these words. For this is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. We should not be like Cain, who was of the evil one and murdered his own brother. And why did he murder him? Because his own deeds were evil and his brothers were righteous. Do not be surprised, brothers, that the world hates you. We know that we have passed out of death into life because we love the brothers. Whoever does not love abides in death. Everyone who hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. Here's the key. Stop killing each other. Don't murder anymore. There you go. Write it down. You guys are all just looking at me like I've said something stupid, but that's a quote from the text. Don't kill and murder one another. Isn't it amazing how churches would grow if we wouldn't kill each other off? You know, Klein Payden, who started the Sunset School of Preaching, that then became the Sunset International Bible Institute, had this sermon that he would go around preaching saying, what's wrong with the church? Why are we shooting our wounded? And people would say, well, that's insulting to us. But the truth is, we don't want to join a family that hurts its family members. You know, if I were to say, you know, all your Amers that come, I want them to come live with me in my house and just hang out with me. Now, I do have some problems. I do beat my wife. But I want you to come and send me your children. I would love to be there with them. Oh, okay, I shot one of my sons. But just send me your kids. We've got extra bed space now. You'd go, well, that's crazy. Yet we turn to our world and we hate one another. We fight one another. We struggle against one another. If someone does something we don't like, we nail them. And then we turn to our world and say, and why don't you come join us? Because God is love. And they say, well, we'd be happy to join God. But we're not sure about the rest of this. We have to learn not to kill one another. It says here that we are not to hate our brother. If we hate our brother, we're a murderer. And at first I looked at that and I thought, not a problem. I don't hate any brother. And then I looked up the definition for what the word hate meant 2,000 years ago in the Greek language. And this is the definition that they lived by at the time this was written. Hate literally means to disregard someone, ignore the needs of someone, antagonize someone, express anger to someone, refuse to love someone, or to not actively serve or pay attention to someone. That's what it means to hate. If you have a need and I just ignore that, I hated you. If you're hurt and in desperate need of something I can offer and I don't offer that word to you, I hated you. If you have a problem inside your life, I ignore it, I hate you. If you annoy me so I avoid you, I hate you. And as I was going through and reading that, I was going, ugh, I'm a murderer. I've been killing people all over the place. Somebody will come to me and I'll go, oh no, here comes that guy that talks all the time. If I don't get away, he's going to keep me here all day. I hated that brother. And I've had to go to those brothers and say, I'm so sorry. I murdered you. Which is really sort of hard to go up and just tell someone. Well, they haven't been thinking about this stuff. They look at you like, now wait, now what are you talking about? Well, I've been hating. And I can't believe it. But whenever I hate that way, I stop the growth of the Lord's church in its tracks. Let's look at what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, verse 21 and verse 22. It says, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you should not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. Well, that's really serious, isn't it? If I go to one of my brothers and I treat them that way, if I speak out against them, if I say you mean nothing to me, or if I show them they mean nothing to me, look at how Jesus sees that. He sees that as murder, and he sees me as being worthy of the judgment I would receive as a murderer.
Now, that's really strong language, not just from John, the apostle of love, but from Jesus, who was God's love manifested in the flesh. We have to think about the way we act to one another. So I'm going to give you a three-question test today. Three questions to see if you're a hater and a murderer like me. So if you are, don't take it so bad. We can get over this together. Question number one is found in the text, 1 John chapter 3, verse 16. 1 John 3, 16 says, "By this we know love, that we have laid that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers." Question number one is, am I sacrificial with every one of my brothers and sisters in Christ? Do I sacrifice for all of my brothers and sisters? See, we want to say, well, for this sister, I'm very sacrificial. Well, that's great. And that's the way it works in your family. I have to take care of Alan, but I don't have to take care of Daniel. I have to take care of one boy, but not the other. You know, you have to take care of Kim, but not Rhonda. No, that's not the way it works, is it? That's not the way family operates. We have to take care of the whole family. Well, but sometimes they disappoint me. Did you know there is a person in this room that when they were very small, they moved into my house, they made it smell bad, they made it dirty, they screamed in the middle of the night, they absolutely destroyed the perfect world I had created. And his name is David Allen Swinford. He just came in and turned my world upside down. And you know what we did? We sat over his crib going, isn't he the greatest thing in the world? He's woken us up at 4 a.m. again. He's just the greatest. He smells like a, you know, decaying pumpkin. Isn't he the greatest? He is causing us all sorts of problems, no sleep, not able to work. We loved him for it because he was our child. God looks down at his children and says, and don't hate each other. Instead, be sacrificial and love one another. And because I thought you didn't understand it, I sent my son to sacrifice everything for you. Treat one another that way. So we have to ask ourselves, am I being sacrificial in my love to everyone in my Christian family? Think about what it would mean to the world if we did that. Wouldn't you want to join a family like that? If you heard about some group meeting somewhere where everyone was willing to give up everything for each other at a moment's notice, wouldn't that catch your attention? That's what the Lord's church is supposed to be like. We need to be that sacrificial kind of family. Question number two. This question comes from 1 John chapter 3, verse 17. But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Question number two is, do I help every brother or sister with their physical needs? John says, how can you see a brother in need and close your heart? How can you see a brother in need and not open yourself up to them? I was in Houston, Texas, meeting at this congregation, and someone came in and said, there was a family who was worshiping there. Their name was the Robinsons. The Robinsons' little girl fell off a fence she was playing on, and she broke her neck, and we all ran. She was in trouble. Everybody ran. People were holding on to the mother. We all went to the hospital together. We all sat there, and amazingly, after a few months, she was okay. That's amazing to me. I don't know how they put the pieces back together, but they do. But everyone immediately stopped everything. And this family, who was a little poor, was saying, we don't know what we're going to do about the hospital bill. And I saw men taking out their checkbooks and saying, here, put this in the bank. You take care of this. And in about 25 minutes, she raised $65,000 if it was necessary to take care of her daughter. And I thought, that's the church at its best, isn't it? Instantly, all over it. We're going to take care of this. You're in need. We're going to fill this need. They put people there sitting with them around the clock. And what I loved was, it was little girls. We're going in there and sitting by their friend, dangling their legs off the chair, sitting with their friend, waiting for her to wake up so they could make her feel good. It's a great story.
But there are people hurting and need all the time. And they're our family. Boy, it's hard when you go out into the third world and you're surrounded in poverty and you know you can't do everything for every person. Okay, well, you can't do everything for every person, but you can make them a sandwich and some soup or dessert and take out there once a week, can't you, Michael? Absolutely. You can go to the little lady's house like James and his friends did and take her something to eat and sit down with her at the table and make her feel like the queen for that day. You can do something. It always reminds me of the story of the little boy who was walking along the shore and he would pick up a starfish and he would throw it in the water. And a wise, more elderly man said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm saving starfish." And he said, "Look at the beach. There's so many. You can't save them all." And he said, "Yep, save this one. I can save this one." And throws it in. And that becomes our job in life. We'll never meet every need, but we can always be meeting needs. I love my wife for a million different reasons. And if you've got 6 weeks, I'll tell you every one of them. She's the greatest. But my favorite thing about her was I did not allow people to give money to beggars in Ukraine or anywhere. I don't believe you help people by giving them money. But my wife carried bread and fruit and things like that and gave it away all the time. She was just constantly giving it out. Didn't cost us that much, but it meant the world to those people who would receive it. And that's what we've got to do. We just got to be out there helping. But if you withhold that, you hate them. We can't be haters that way. Wouldn't you like to be part of a church family where you knew if you had a need, it'd be filled? Wouldn't that be great? You know, I was listening to Michael at the end of his talk. It was so incredible. And then he had this really bad part of his talk where he said, "I hate to ask you this. This is really embarrassing. I don't want to do this. I'll be happy to go with you anywhere you want, and I'll ask for you." But he was asking for money to go and study at sunset to go change the world. I'm not a bit shy about that. Empty the pockets. You've always got a little bit, don't you? Don't you got some somewhere? You can always find a little bit to change the world through a great young person like him. There's always that kind of opportunity. And I hope that he'll come back to Alaska because there's not enough preachers and ministers in Alaska and pay it back a million times over. But we can't see someone like that in need and not respond. How can you look at one of those aimers write you back? Let's say that Ben writes you back and says, "I'm starving. I just don't have anything." What would you be willing to give up so he could eat? Well, what does he need? But we have to be that way with everyone, and we would love to find a church body that was like that. Finally, question number 3, 1 John chapter 3, verse 18. And whenever I say finally, I'm not near through, so don't get your hopes up. Finally, 1 John 3:18 says, "Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth." The third question is, do I have actions that show that I love every brother and sister? Do my actions show that? I was a teacher at Fort Worth Christian Schools. I was a baseball coach a little bit, softball coach a lot, soccer coach a little bit, and I taught Bible. I even got to teach my son Alan Bible while I was there, and that was a nice experience. I'm sure he enjoyed it as much as I did. Okay, he didn't enjoy it that much. I used him as examples all the time. That's sort of death for kids. So, but I was blessed to be able to teach that, and I loved being there. And one thing I learned while teaching in a high school is kids are really mean. Kids are like packs of animals where everything's suddenly fine, then one of them shows a little weakness, and kids turn with barred teeth and tear that person to pieces. And it really, really scared me because my children were going to school in that kind of environment all the time. It was a little bit like that when I was growing up. Man, it was just sometimes wicked the way people would treat each other. Now, there was a lot of parts of the day that were really good, but if someone showed a weakness or if they did something that other people saw as funny, man, it was bad. I hated it. And then I thought, wow, they're so much like their parents. Because it's not just a child's game. Sometimes we do that kind of thing as well. Now, we sit in places like this and, oh, we love each other.
family, family, love, love, grace, grace, peace, peace. But what are our actions saying as we go about through our day? What are we showing the world and showing God by the things that we do for each other? We have to have actions that show that we love each other. I would stand in front of those kids and go, "This is Fort Worth Christian School. Did y'all forget the Christian part?" "Oh, yeah, but she got braces." "Well, okay, it's all off then. She gets braces." "Well, she's our sister, but it's fun to make fun of her." "Well, you're killing her. You got to stop." And it's that way with all of us. The words don't mean a lot when the actions don't match up. I can stand here and say, "Oh, I care for you, B. You're one of my favorite people. B needs help." And I go, "Hey, you heard the lesson. I'm through. I've done my part." We have to be people that follow up things with real action. It's amazing to me that in John chapter 13, Jesus washed Judas's feet. Washing Peter's feet, you know, he was argumentative, all this kind of stuff. When we look at that part of the story, but we want Peter's feet washed, don't we? Good old Peter. John, we want John's feet washed. Andrew, sure. Even Bartholomew, and we're not even really sure who he is. Let's wash his feet. But whenever he washes Judas's feet, we sort of go, "Man, you know what's happening, don't you? How can you do that? How can you send Judas out to betray you with clean feet and then go to the cross with dirty feet on yourself?" Well, he had been preaching that he loved them all. And he loved every one of them until the very end. But more than saying those words, he had to get his hands wet and his knees dirty, washing the feet of every one of them, even Judas. We must learn to serve one another that way. Let's look at 1 John chapter 3, verse 19 through verse 24. This is the much nicer part. "By this we shall know that we are of the truth and reassure our heart before him. For whenever our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart, and he knows everything. Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence before God. And whatever we ask, we receive from him, because we keep his commandments and we do what pleases him. And this is his commandment, that we believe in the name of the Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another just as he has commanded us. Whoever keeps his commandments abideth in him, and he in them. And by this we know that he abideth in us, by the Spirit whom he has given us." So what are we supposed to do? Well, we're supposed to keep his commandments and do what pleases God. This is what I tell my sons all the time. "What's your job as my son? Do what I tell you to do and make me happy as your dad. And I'll take care of the electric bill, the gas bill, all those things. You don't have to worry about any of that. Just do the things that I would have you do and please me and your mom." I don't think it's too much to ask for. Basically, I always tell the boys, you know, in Aramaic, the word for child and slave is the exact same word. Just remember that as we go through. And some of you parents might want to use that on your kids as well. What pleases God? First, belief in Jesus. That pleases God. He doesn't want you going, "Oh, no, I didn't believe it." How would you like to give your child's life for something and people go, "Well, I'm not sure if I believe that happened or not"? Horrible. We're to believe in Jesus, and secondly, we must love our brothers and sisters. That's how we prove our belief in Jesus. And if we believe in Jesus, we love our brothers and sisters. It says if we do these things, God will answer our prayers and will live inside of us. I don't know about you, but I like to have my prayers answered. I like to see those things occur. Well, if I'm pleasing God, following his commandments, loving my brothers and sisters, then that's the kind of thing that can happen. Well, this wasn't just John's message. This was the consistent theme of Jesus. In fact, this is one of Jesus' favorite things to talk about. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 23 through verse 24, he says, "If you are taking your offering to the tent of the tent of meeting, the doorway of the tent of meeting, and you remember that you and your brother have any problem of any kind, if you have, as it says in the King James, aught against your brother," I had to go look that one up, "but if you have anything against your brother, you leave your sacrifice there at the doorway and you go to them and you make it right with them. And then you come back and you worship God." Because loving brothers and sisters is something we have to do in order to stand well before the throne of God. We have to have that done first. Whenever Jesus said this, it would have been shocking. Because the religious leaders of his time said, I know you hate all these people. They do things wrong all the time. Just make sure you have a good sacrifice and everything's okay. And Jesus said, that's wrong. You make yourself right with them and then you come to us. You go before God. In Matthew chapter 25, verse 31 through verse 46, we have the separation of the sheep and goats. Sheep on the right hand, the goats on the left side. And Jesus goes through and says, okay, here's what we do. Those people who didn't feed, who didn't visit, who didn't care, who didn't give drink, you're going away to an eternal punishment that was prepared for the devil and his angels. Those of you who did these things, you can go live in heaven in my Father's home with me. And those people who didn't do that went, wait a second. If you'd have just told us it was you, we would have done it. We thought it was just one of our brothers or sisters. And Jesus said, no, as much as you do it to the least of them, you do that to me. It's personal. When we take care of each other, we minister to Christ that way. And he says, those are the people I want to bring with me, are those who ministered to one another. You get to go into the Father's home and into joy. I wish we believed this, and I wish we understood it, because if we did, we'd be at the door of the prison banging on the door going, hey, let me in there. I got to serve somebody. There's people in prison, and I want to be in there talking to them. Because when I do it for them, I do it for Jesus. Going to the old folks' home, bang, 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 let me in. Going to the orphans, come on, let me in there. I got to help. Because when I do this, I'm doing it for Jesus himself. And when you go to any of your brothers and sisters and do something good, whether they deserve it or not, you're doing that for Jesus. And he notices that. And he cares about that. Finally, in John chapter 13, verse 34 and verse 35, we need to realize that the world will only see us as true disciples if we're actively serving one another in love. Jesus says, this is the way people know who the real church is, who true disciples are. If you do just exactly what I've just done for you, which was serving each other in a heart of love, that's how you know who the real guys are. It scares me when I go across the world and I hear people say, well, I wished we loved each other as much as the Mormons do. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? We have to win this battle. We have to be the ones that meet each other's needs more than anyone else, anywhere, anytime, any place, because the world is not just flipping through the phone book going, well, you know, this is a good location. They are looking at our membership going, who's the ones taking care of each other? Who are the true disciples of Christ? And they've got to be able to look at it and say, it's you guys. I like being with you because this is the way you are. And we've got to be that kind of people. And it's hard. One of my teachers' name was Abraham Lincoln. Isn't that funny? Abe Lincoln. It's crazy. We had a student named John Booth. And it was funny when Abe Lincoln gave this academic award to John Booth. We were going, wow, history really played out in a funny way. Or John Wilkes Booth shot Abraham. Okay. Yeah, doesn't matter. But Abe Lincoln used to say, you know, we've got to love each other, warts and all, and I've got some brothers with warts on top of their warts on top of their warts. But it's true. We got to love each other that way anyway. And not just in word, we've got to do it in deed, and we got to take care of each other and hold each other tighter. And when we do, the world looks at it, they fall to their knees and say, thank God the church is here. I want to be a part of that. I want to be in that group. I don't want to be in the place that's killing each other, that's hurting each other, that's talking bad about each other, that leaves each other in need. I want to be in that group. And that ultimately becomes the key to church growth. I hate the fact that I was a murderer. I went to 7 different people at sunset and said, I'm sorry. This one guy is the most devout liberal Democrat in the history of man. And I am a son of the most conservative Republican politician in the state. Texas Monthly said 7 years in a row. I mean, I've got this part down. Sarah Palin, she's a liberal compared to my dad. Probably shouldn't tell him that. But this guy always hurt my feelings. He would always say things like, well, you guys, you do this. And I'd go, okay, I'm not my father. Don't be putting this on me. And finally, I looked at him and said, you know, you're right. I agree with my dad on everything, and I don't want you to talk to me about this anymore. And we quit talking. Murdering each other. There was another guy who just talked forever. Longer than me. Can you imagine? He would always talk, and it was about things that I didn't care about. He was from France, which means B knows who he is. His name's Frederick. I would see Frederick coming. I would dive behind anybody, dive into any door to get away from this guy. And then I thought, I'm hating him. I'm killing him. I had to go to these people and say, this is what I've done to you, and I'm so sorry. I want the church to grow, and I want to be like Christ in this world, and I've got to get myself right with you. What do I got to do to make our relationship right? I'm going to be actively serving you every day, trying to get this right. I want to close by sharing a story with you from Ukraine. Whenever I share a story and it's from Ukraine, there's a chance for tears. There's a chance for all sorts of things. I love it. Whenever I first went to Ukraine, I showed up with my wife, Brenda, my two boys who were still quite small, and eight giant trunks that all weighed exactly 50 pounds. Not 49.4 pounds. They were all 50 pounds. Because that's the way we had to pack, because that was all of our worldly belongings that we were going to have with us. So we show up, and a young man named Maxime showed up to help us with our bags. Maxime was a special. We called him Special Max. He was incredibly unique. When Maxime was born, they used forceps on his head, and they crushed a part of his beautiful little brain. And because they did that, he was never going to be smarter than about a 12-year-old. In fact, that was a lofty goal to get to that point. But Max was a big, strong guy. Very, very happy. Very lovely. And he had asked somebody at the school, can I go with you to pick up Brother Chris and his family, because I will carry their trunks for them. And he carried two of those trunks at a time, one in each hand. And I looked at him and thought, you're one of the greatest young men I've ever met in my life. Carried them out across the railroad tracks, all that, sticks them inside the van, we move, he takes them in and all this, and the boys were so scared of everybody and everything, and they just sat there staring at everything that would happen, including Special Max, because it was just an unusual thing for us to be moving into a foreign environment. But I never forgot Maxine. We would go to different church buildings. Max went to 8 worship services a day. Started in the early morning, and he would just travel on the bus to make sure he went to as many as he could possibly go to. And in every one of those congregations, he had a job. In 3 of the congregations, his job was putting the chairs in order. They were perfect. He had put tape on the ground, and he had put the back places on the tape, and he would have it all set up. And you'd walk in, and you'd go, wow, Max, you did a great job. Good for you. But every place, one place he did songbooks, he would put them down straight and then turn them at a 45-degree angle on every chair. Perfect. Everything was perfect. So you would go in there and I'd say, Maxie, it's good to see you today. We would hug and kiss. You had to kiss a lot in Ukraine and Russia. Especially, I'd always say, the older the lady, the wetter the kiss. You know, you'd walk in, they'd be going, oh no, please. I'm from Texas, we don't do this. But anyway, we got good at it. And James can tell you, you just have to take it. But anyway, we would go all through all this, and Maxime was always there. And then he became sort of a groupie. He'd follow me around, and he was always there everywhere I would go, and I really came to love Max a lot. Maxime came to me one day and said, I want to go to school at sunset. I want to be at the Ukrainsky Biblinsky Institute, which was the name of our institute there, the Ukrainian Bible Institute. And I said, Maxime, you know I love you, but you can't do the work. And he said, so you're going to withhold teachings of God from me. Now, that's pretty tough. That kid, he wasn't somebody didn't know anything. He knew the button to push. So I said, okay, I'll go talk to the other guys. I'll go talk to Doug and Denny, and we'll see what we can do. So I went and talked to them, and they said, no, we really can't have him in the classroom. He's a distraction. And I said, are we going to withhold God from him? Is that what we're going to do? And they said, I'll tell you what, he can be in your classes. So I went to him and said, you can be in my class. And then I looked at what I was teaching next, and it was New Testament Greek in the morning. Bum, 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 bum. It was intro to exegesis in the afternoon. Bum, 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 bum. And then it was evangelism class. Bum, 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 bum. He was going to love that one. So anyway, we went in, and Maxie was there, and he was waiting, and he was sitting on the front row, and he had his... He had his pens, and he had his legal pad, and he was just trembling all over. He was so excited. I went up to the board and drew an alpha, which looks like an A with a little tail on the top. Drew an alpha up there, and he started scribbling alphas all over his piece of paper and all that. And we were having such a good time. And then I drew beta, and he was still trying to learn alpha. Then we went to gamma, and he was still trying to learn alpha, and you get the picture. About a week and a half later, he's still going, now how do I get the alpha? And I'm going, oh boy. It's going to be hard. But he did the best he could. He would try to learn the words. I gave 40 vocabulary words a day, and he tried. He just couldn't learn any of them. I told him, it's okay. Come to class, do the best you can, and I'll take care of the grades. You take care of the work. And he said, okay. Then we went into exegesis, and I said, okay, step number one is you've got to read the New Testament. That was going to take him 8 years. And he didn't understand half the vocabulary. And everything we talked about, he was just going crazy. The first day, I walk up to the board, and I write out epistemology. Why we believe what we believe. It's a big part of Bible interpretation, is realizing that you already carry some beliefs in. You've got to understand why you believe the things that you believe. And we were going through this, and Maxime's eyes started to water, and he was looking at me, and I went, I'm sorry, Max, this is just the way this goes. This is what you got to do. It destroyed him, but he tried. Now, evangelism class was different. He was the most aggressive evangelist we had. People would ask questions, and he would cry. He didn't know how to answer them, but he would try really hard. One day during the evangelism class, I said, we're just going to go serve. Just perform random acts of kindness for other people. And I said, we've got different things we can do. One of the things, we're going to go to a nursing center for the aged here in Donetsk. Our nursing homes in America are so nice, so clean compared to those of most other countries. This one was, the closest thing I can call it is a sewer with beds. It was a horrible place. But we went in, I talked to the woman there, Svetlana, and said, Svetlana, we would like to come in and we would like to help you. We'll do anything we can. And then I pulled her aside and said, you know I'm a psychologist, right? I will come in and talk with people about their problems. But make a list of duties, and then we will have everyone else do all those things. Make them as dirty as you want. But I'm going to talk to people about their problems. And she said, okay, okay. And I said, thank you very much. We show up the next day. I announce how this is going to work. I said, first, we need to divide into pairs. Maxie, you're with me. That was safest. Maxime had this little tendency to get lost every now and then. So I said, Maxie, you're with me. And he said, yes, I get to be with Chris. So anyway, we're standing there. Everybody's dividing up into teams. Svetlana comes out and says, okay, I've got these list of jobs. Y'all can volunteer for the job you want. And I'm thinking, I'm going to be talking to people about their problems. Got it. Number one, cleaning out bedpans. And Maxime goes, me! I want to do that one! And I'm looking at him going, Maxime, no! You don't want to do that one. I said, Maxime, remember you're with me. And he said, I want to do the number one job. It's the best job. And I said, Maxime, it's the worst job. And he said, brother, hasn't Jesus taught us to take those kinds of jobs? And I looked at him and thought, Maxime, you're really getting on my nerves. And I said, yes, all right, we'll take that job. We started with the bedpans that had been sitting for over a month. We started with those. We used a screwdriver to clean bedpans. Now, that's how bad this deal was. We had a cold bucket of water, two different sizes of brushes, and a screwdriver. It was horrible. So we cleaned and we cleaned and we cleaned, and we were so happy when we got to all the fresh ones from that day. It was horrible. I had to just throw my clothes away when I got home. Brenda wouldn't let me in the apartment. Sad. What's with her problem? But anyway, we had all this thing. So we're sitting there. I'm worried about every disease known to man. There's cholera, tuberculosis, AIDS, hepatitis. Everything was in this place. So anyway, we get through and we get through cleaning. We go back. I tell Svetlana, I'm so grateful for this opportunity. Thank you very much. We go back to the school. We all change clothes and all, burn my clothes. Next day we show up, I begin teaching Greek, and Maxie's not there. So anybody seen Maxime? He's not here. It was unheard of for Maxime not to show up. But I thought, well, he might have gotten sick from cold water and nasty. Because I'll admit, he did more of the bedpans than his teacher. He actually worked really hard, and I was just spending all my time going, ooh, ooh. So I said, maybe he just needed to sleep late. Exegesis came up, and he wasn't there. Evangelism came up, and he wasn't there. And I said, okay, boys, spread out. I'll walk to his mom's house. You guys spread out. We've got to find Maxime. We couldn't find him. Then I was walking back, and I saw the nursing center and went, do you think maybe he's back there? So I walk in and go in and ask, and they said, oh, my goodness. Maxime has cleaned every floor, every window, every wall, every wheelchair. He's straightened every bed. He's in there washing sheets by hand. He is the most amazing thing in the world. I went back there and said, Maxime, your mama didn't know where you were. I didn't know where you were. You know that's not supposed to happen. You're in big trouble, mister. And he looked at me and he said, I can't do Greek. I can't do exegesis. But I can clean, and I'm going to clean, because this is the way I serve Jesus. For the next 3 months, he cleaned every day. That place was so clean. And you just walk through it, and you'd just be amazed at how good it smelled and all that. And then you would look back there, and you'd see Maxime on his hands and knees with a scrub brush cleaning the floor that he cleaned already that morning. He was all over it. After about 3 months, his mom called me and said, Maxime hasn't come home. I go to the nursing center. They say he's already left. And we find Maxime near his home. He's very sick. We take him to the hospital, and he dies. It's like having my third child die. Breaks my heart. And if you've ever been really close to a special person like that, you know that it'll kill you. And I hurt, and I ached. I went and talked to his mom, and she said, you at the school, y'all will do this. Tim Burrow, my partner in Mariupol, came to be with me. Our other guys from the school, we were all there. And we gave him the greatest funeral we could ever give anybody. We all loved him. When we were just about to the part where I take the hammer and nail the nails into the coffin, which is part of the work of the preacher there. Funerals are a little different. But as we were just about to that point, and we were going to put him in the ground, then we would share a meal with him. We would eat part of the meal and then brush the other part off into the ground to share that meal. As we were getting ready for all this, a bus showed up, and it was the people from the nursing center. The nurses came out, and they were so starched. And then the scrape of walkers and canes and a woman with short crutches that drug herself behind them began to go through the graves and the tombstones towards us. As Svetlana came up and said, I don't know what your religion is. I don't really understand it, but I know it's not Orthodox. But we would just want to be like Max. And if this was his church, we want it to be yours. She said, can you tell me about Max's church? And I said, Maxie doesn't have a church. He has a family. It's the Church of Jesus Christ. And she grabbed my hands and she said, then give me Jesus Christ. We baptized 44 that day. Over the next 3 months, that 44 became 97. And it just kept going. I would be sitting at my desk, and someone would come and say, "Aren't you Maxie's teacher?" And I would go, "Oh, come on. You've got to be kidding me." And then one day I was sitting at my desk, and I was giving grades, and I had my evangelism stuff out, and I gave him 1 million. I don't know how you average in a score of 1 million, but I wanted to give him what he was worth. He changed the church. Today, in the whole Soviet Union, there are almost 400 churches. There are 360 of them in Donetsk, where we had our evangelism class. And the reason we were so evangelistic is we saw evangelism done the best way, by a guy who just loved everybody and took care of everybody. And if I live to be a million, I don't know that I'll ever be as good as my student who became my teacher. And I learned a valiant lesson. Knowing every answer is not nearly as important as loving every brother and sister and helping out as best you can. Maxime was not a murderer, and he changed the world. I hope you'll change your world. Let's pray and we'll be finished. Dear Father, I thank you so much for this day. We've had such an opportunity to come together and bless one another. I've been edified, and I pray that we all have been. Father, you work through your children. You work through Maxie, you work through Chi, you work through so many of your children in this world. And Father, you are yearning to work through those of us in this room. If we will just love one another, take care of one another, and work together as the Lord's church, you will grow the church around the world continually for as long as we're in this world, until you bring us home to be with you forever. And Father, we just pray for the heart of a servant that will love and care for each and every brother and sister so that we can grow the church. And Father, keep us from being murderers and help us to be simple and compliant and perfect for you. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.